and welcome back to Current State on WKAR. We're pleased you haven't lost track of us. Current State is a weekend program here in 2017, Saturdays and Sundays on both 90.5 FM and AM 870 WKAR, not to mention at WKAR.org, and of course the Current State podcast goes forward. Among the many developments this past week, confirmation hearings for cabinet appointees in the new Trump administration. This week, Michigan billionaire Betsy DeVos faced U.S. Senate confirmation hearings as President Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of Education. Derek Wallbank is following DeVos. Wallbank is also rooted in Michigan. He's an MSU grad and formerly of the Lansing State Journal. Wallbank is now an editor for Bloomberg News in Washington, where he covers the White House and Congress for First Word, the breaking news desk. WKAR's Peter Wharf speaks with Derek Wallbank, who tells us that while Betsy DeVos faced sharp criticism from Democratic senators this week, Wallbank believes she's in a position to receive the appointment.
Republicans have all the votes that they need for Betsy DeVos, it looks like. We've got no indication that there are Republicans breaking off of her. So it looks like she's going to go through. But you're talking about somebody who really wants to come in and radically shake things up. You're also talking about somebody who has lived her life pretty much outside of the public school system. For her own impacts. You know, Betsy DeVos and her husband Dick DeVos are billionaires. They don't need federal student loans. She openly wants to switch up the way that everything goes in public education. You've seen this in Michigan. You've seen her push for charter schools in the state of Michigan. You've seen the battles between groups that she has heavily funded and the teachers' union in Michigan. Those clashes that have been so apparent in our home state are just coming to Washington, but more. You can sit there and look for possible fights on where federal funding can go. There has been a push to allow federal funding to sort of follow the child, as it were, rather than be defined to districts. And that's a key part of how charter schools operate. But then what if you say, well, maybe it's not just charter schools, maybe it's private schools, maybe it's parochial schools, religious schools, and then you get into sort of this, could you send federal funding for a child to go to a school where maybe not all children would be accepted because there's, you know, the school is catering to one specific religion. There's a lot of question marks that get in there, and these are a lot of things that a lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill just couldn't believe their ears and are furious about.
Peter Wharf for WKAR News with Derek Wallbank, MSU grad, formerly of the Lansing State Journal. He's editor for Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C., covering the White House and Congress for First Word and the breaking news desk. What do you know about this Acton Academy that Betsy DeVos speaks very highly of? Many of these schools are opening across the U.S. Some have recently opened, slated for open in Michigan. There are some three dozen of these across the country.
She's been so on charters. She really has. Right. And one of the things that I'm curious about is where she's going to land on for-profit colleges, and where she's going to land on accountability. And one of the biggest moments I saw, you know, I used to cover Al Franken very, very closely, and his exchange with her, how you track achievement, whether you track it in terms of absolutes or in terms of improvement, it's like a seminal question in the education community, and she sort of kind of froze,
right?
Frankly. But I actually really want to know the answer to that.
Derek Wallbank is editor for Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C. He covers the White House and Congress for First Word, the breaking news desk. Derek, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
For WKAR, this is Peter Wharf.
And coming up on Current State, what motivates a TV star to write plays? Matthew Lecher says it makes him happier than anything. Coming up, Scott Pohl talks with the Scandal star about Smart Love coming to the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea. Well, festivities associated with the 58th presidential inauguration began Thursday afternoon with a welcome concert at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. Lansing's Everett High School Viking Marching Band was there to perform. WKAR's Katie Cook stopped by their rehearsal earlier in the week to see how the preparations were going.
The Everett High School band room is buzzing with excitement. The band was invited to participate in the presidential inauguration festivities, and it's their final rehearsal at the school before they head to Washington, D.C.
Does everyone have their permission slips turned in?
Yes.
Who has not turned their permission slip in?
In November, band director Penny Falanchuk applied for the band to participate in the inauguration. Then in December, she got the call that they were invited to play in the welcoming concert on Thursday, the day before the inauguration.
I was quite surprised and almost was taken aback and kind of thought, is this for real?
The students' reactions to this invitation were much like their director's.
I was the first one that Falanchuk called, and I was laying in bed and I popped up just screaming, no way, no way, just like a little girl. And I was excited and I was very proud of my band.
I was like, oh my gosh, it's my first time going to D.C. Like, I was excited.
That's drum major Charles Timms II and trombone player Camille Rees. Camille says people have questioned her about why the band is going in light of the controversial president-elect.
A lot of people keep saying, oh, like, why are you guys going and doing this for Trump? It's kind of for him, but not really. Like, it's basically for everyone to me. Like, we're not doing it just for him.
I would say that we're not really playing for him at all.
That's snare drum player Kira Rivett.
We just happen to be at the inauguration where he's getting elected, because whether he's getting elected or Hillary was getting elected, we would be there. Or if neither of them got elected, we would still be there. So we just want to go and play and have the experience of being in D.C.
It's not really about politics for Charles Timms either.
I see it as performing with a group of people that I love, performing and doing what I love to do, and that is music. And yes, I do see it as performing in front of the president and the country, but just having that experience and performing, anyone performing, it's a great experience, even if it's on the street corner or in front of the United States.
Camille Rees says playing at the inauguration means a lot to her.
A couple years from now, you know, when like everyone's grown and have their own family, and you get to tell your kids, oh, look, I did this when I was your age, so, yeah.
Kira Rivett agrees that it's a special opportunity.
I feel like we're a part of history and making history at Everett. We're the first band at Everett to go to the inauguration. And also, since this is such a, like, weird election, you know, it's going to be a big part of history that everyone's going to remember.
Everett will be one of 12 groups performing at the concert, which takes place in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Penny Falanchuk says most of the songs they'll be playing are ones they already knew, but not all.
Well, the kids did have to learn one new song, the Grand Old Flag song. We had to order that and get it memorized, and they did that in about a week. So it's been quite exciting to see them work really hard for something.
The band has had to raise money to send all 47 members to D.C., and they haven't quite met their goal. Everyone from parents to local businesses has pitched in.
And it's been a big blessing to see the community reach out to these kids and give them this opportunity.
Good, good, that's fast.
For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
And you're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea is about to stage the world premiere of a new play. It's by TV star and playwright Brian Letcher. He plays Tom Larson, a murderous Secret Service agent on the hit series Scandal. Increasingly, he's adding writing credits to his resume. Smart Love is the second of his plays to be chosen by artistic director Guy Sanville. WKAR Scott Pohl went to Chelsea to talk with Brian Letcher about Scandal and Smart Love.
Well, it involves a family in Hamtramck, a mother, a father, and a son, or did involve a father. And it, you know, the backstory is the it's about 8 months after the father's death of a sudden heart attack, cardiac arrest, and now we pick it up 8 months later, and the mother and son have gone in different directions following that passing, and the son begins to find out things he didn't know. He's 25 years old, and all of a sudden, the fully formed human that his parents are come to life, and he learns a lot more, and he does something about that. He has a very specific plan about how he's going to bring his family back together.
Are there some laughs here?
It definitely has a lot of humor in it.
For the benefit of listeners who haven't watched Scandal, tell us about your character, Tom Larson.
Tom is a wonderful man.
End of story.
Scene.
Unfortunately, there's a big ellipsis there, followed by, but he kills a lot of people. Tom Larson started off as the number one Secret Service agent to President Fitzgerald Grant. And then it was revealed that I was actually a black ops government spy who was spying on the president, and then did some really bad things, which included assassinating the president's son.
The president went in and he just... The other three agents stayed outside in the hall, but eventually I went in too because of the sound. He was making this noise, not crying, more like... I don't know. I've never heard a noise like that before. He stopped when I came in and we just didn't talk about it.
And since then, you know, he's had to do what he's had to do to protect the Republic. And I think that's the way Tom looks at it. He was someone who comes from a very rough past, and B613 is the name of the government agency, and that agency saved him. And so I'm going to do what I need to do to honor that agency and protect the Republic, and increasingly so protect my own life. And maybe even outside of that, maybe find something that resembles love. So it's a lot.
I have one last question about Scandal, and that has to do with the perception that people have that when you're on a big hit show, A, you're very busy, and B, you're making a lot of money. So that leads to questions. How do you find time to write, and why bother writing? You, one would assume, don't really have to write. So how do you find the time, and what's your motivation?
I can't answer to what my motivation is other than it makes me happier than anything. And I just began to notice that along the way. I started writing, 11 or 12 years ago, maybe longer. And I realized when I wasn't writing, there was always a story that I was thinking about, jotting notes down about something. And if I wasn't writing it, there was a part of me that was unhappy. I think I have to write. I think the simple answer is I really have to write. And I don't see that changing.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
And coming up on Current State, I continue my conversation with Bob Trezise, the CEO of LEAP, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. He offers an update on the Red Cedar Renaissance development and the possible impact of the Trump administration. That's on the way. It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Electricity is an abundant power source, but harnessing electricity for everyday use is sometimes tricky. Society's increasing range of portable electronic devices challenges power grids to run more efficiently. But what if you could charge your smartphone with your own body? That question's being studied at Michigan State University with a device that uses nanotechnology. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
All right, a show of hands. How many times has that old alarm gone off at oh dark 30, you barely open one eye and think, I just don't have the energy to get out of bed? But what if the physical motion of getting out of bed actually created the energy you need to face the day, even if it's just enough to turn on the coffee? Okay, you can put your hand down. By the way, just as you spent energy to raise your hand, you were generating it too. Every time we move, the machine we live in, our body, gives off energy. And that mechanical force can be converted into electricity. And that's the concept that drives the work of Dr. Nelson Sepulveda and his research team at Michigan State University. Sepulveda is an associate professor of electrical and computer engineering. We're in his lab, where he's showing me a small, thin, reflective sheet of silicone. It's called the FENG, short for ferroelectric nanogenerator.
Whenever it is pressed, whenever it experiences some mechanical deflection, it generates some electricity. It is flexible, it generates a substantial amount of power, electric power per unit stress, and it increases the output by just folding.
When the FENG is compressed, it gets stronger and can create up to 4 times its original power capacity. The secret lies in layers. Let's go back to the getting out of bed analogy. Sepulveda thinks about sheets and blankets. There's pockets of air between each layer, but they're not exactly empty.
Imagine that within each bed sheet layer, you have really, really tiny particles that are charged, that have a positive or negative charge.
Those ions don't like being pushed around, and so if you press your hand on the stack of blankets, they're going to fight back, quietly.
And the way they do that is by creating an electric field that generates a force that opposes the mechanical deflection. And that electric field is what generates the electric power that we're extracting from the device.
To demonstrate this, we enlist the help of doctoral student Wei Li. He dons a latex glove and places a cloth over the silicone patch, the nanogenerator, 2 small wires connected to an LED circuit board.
So what he's going to do, he's going to press this thing, and I want you to look like normal to the LEDs and see how they start blinking as he applies the pressure on it. So go ahead and get closer, like normal view on this thing.
Okay, I see Wei is pushing down with the palm of his hand. He's got a cloth between his hand and the plates, and I am seeing green and blue lights that are blinking.
Which are the colors that consume more energy. That's why we picked them. If they were red, that means that there's not too much energy, but they're green and blue, which, and this is all, there's no batteries attached. You can describe it to people. The people trust you. You're in the radio, so people trust you. There's no batteries attached anywhere. All the energy is actually coming from him pressing this thing. That's all.
Sepulveda gives much of the credit for the FENG's origin to his student, Wei Li. Li says even as electronic devices become smaller and more portable, they still only hold a very limited charge.
So I was thinking about the idea, if we can use this energy to charge the wearable or the portable device, that will solve the problem of shortage of the battery.
The MSU team says once it's fully developed, the FENG might one day charge your smartphone for an entire week, not just a few hours. That's just one possibility for the device. But Nelson Sepulveda says those advances will take time. There's still a lot of lab work left to do.
We need to understand all the parameters that actually play a role in the performance of the device. And once we do that, I think that we'll be in business.
And when might that business arrive? Sepulveda predicts it will take about 5 years for the FENG to make it out of his lab and onto the market. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last year, 50 African-American women from Flint were selected to have their portrait taken as part of a project meant to reveal the beauty and souls of black women. For this exhibit, Women of a New Tribe, opening this weekend at the Flint Institute of Arts, WKAR's Jamie Paisley met one of these extraordinary women.
As I walked into the Healthy Dollar store on the corner of First and Beach Streets in downtown Flint, Kathy Jackson was busy making a smoothie for a customer.
Yeah, I just made one that had spinach in it, mango, pineapple.
I grew up in Flint. I had a great education here. I mean, Flint was a rich city. I remember when I was in 9th grade in civics class, I wrote a story about Flint. I don't know why. My teacher, Miss Calkins, she always encouraged me to write. Well, because I was always bossy in the classroom against the teacher. You know, how you know? What? How you know everything? How come you know that? So, you know, were you like that too? So she always kind of liked that. So, y'all, and I found out that Flint was number 3 in the nation in per capita income.
Kathy would ultimately take that direction from Miss Calkins to heart and wound up with a long and well-traveled career in automotive journalism, but eventually returned to Flint in part because of her mother.
Well, yeah, I came back here and she was getting older and she passed away in May. So, but yeah, I came back here and I wanted to, I was getting a little tired of journalism. It was right at that point where it was all this internet stuff. So I bought this building a couple of years before I even came back to Flint. The building, you know, the inspectors, it was in pretty, I mean, it was real raggedy, but it was solid.
When it came time to buying, you could look in the window and see how it was in the store property, but how was it upstairs?
It was just outrageous, just totally. I mean, there was no heat up there, there was no furnace up there, and it was just a mess. That's all I can say. But the building was solid. The powers to be keep saying, oh, the vibrant nightlife. There's no vibrant nightlife down here. I mean, I live here. I live in this building. I've spent a lot of money here. There's nobody here walking around. I mean, at Christmas time, nobody's coming to downtown Flint because there's nothing to do. There's not enough diversity. There's nothing for the college kids coming here all the time. I think they think I'm halfway cool. They at least can come in my store and listen to some music and talk, just like the young man who just left. They're bored, and they have nothing. They say they want to be a college town. That's what I hear, but I don't see it. I mean, you can't get a hot dog now. You can't get any fried chicken. You can't get Italian. It's just not diverse enough. No, I think Flint has a long way to go.
Since opening the Healthy Dollar store in downtown Flint, Kathy Jackson has become well-loved, to the point where she was nominated and ultimately selected to have her portrait taken as part of a photo project at the Flint Institute of Arts. The exhibit, Women of a New Tribe, highlights 50 African-American women like Kathy who have made a positive impact on the city and community of Flint.
A young lady who I knew, who used to live in my neighborhood back in the day, called and told me about this. And she said, I want to nominate you. And so I said, fine. And so that's how that happened.
So are you going to the opening night?
Yeah, the opening night. And they said you could bring one guest. And I'm going to have a couple of friends in from Detroit. So I asked them if I could bring two friends. And they said, yeah. So, yeah, I'll be there.
Women of a New Tribe, featuring Kathy Jackson and 49 other fierce Flint women, opens this weekend at the Flint Institute of Arts. More information at flintarts.org. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
All right, okay. Thanks. Okay, I'll be
bye-bye.
Back.
Okay.
And coming right up on Current State, the Obama years are behind us. How did the Great Lakes fare as a result? And Governor Rick Snyder and others are calling for another lock at the Sioux. What would the environmental impact be? Current State's Great Lakes environmental reporter Gary Wilson assesses those issues in his monthly report that's coming up on WKAR's Current State. This is Current State. Stay with WKAR all weekend long at 90.5 FM and AM 870. We're always at WKAR.org as well for weekend edition, all things considered, Current State, lots more. And a reminder that some Current State segments were recorded earlier in the week. There may have been later related developments. 10 million people. Governor Snyder has set a goal of getting Michigan's population above that number before the next U.S. Census. It was part of the governor's seventh State of the State address delivered last Tuesday night at the state capitol. We have more from the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta.
It's been 10 years since more than 10 million people called Michigan home. Thousands fled the state through two recessions and the near collapse of the auto industry. Michigan was the only state in the nation to suffer a net loss of residents in the last census. That cost the state funding for federal programs, the loss of a seat in Congress, and statistical humiliation. The newest numbers say Michigan is now gaining people, but not at the same pace as other states.
We need to grow Michigan. We need to grow our population.
In his State of the State address, Governor Rick Snyder said it's time to accelerate that growth.
Our goal should be to reach 10 million people again. We were there once. We're at 9,928,000. We need 71,000 more people, and let's get them over the next 3 years. Let's put them to work in Michigan.
But the governor offered no specific plans on how to attract those potential future residents. The governor offered a rosy view of the state's economic climate, unemployment below 5%, incomes on the rise, along with home values. He said that should inspire confidence that Michigan is a good place to live. He said Detroit, for example, has emerged from bankruptcy to become a magnet for young people looking to start careers.
We've made Michigan a place that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can truly get ahead. Not just survive, but thrive.
But there are different views on what it would take to make Michigan a place that will attract more people. Republican State House Speaker Tom Leonard says the state's off to a good start now that the Great Recession is over.
People are now coming back home. Population is finally growing. We are on the rise. And I think we can hit that 10 million number in the next 3 years.
For Leonard and the legislature's GOP leaders, the answer is tax cuts. He's pushing for rolling back the state income tax. That's at the same time that Governor Snyder, who was silent on taxes, has called for a multi-million dollar infusion of money into infrastructure. He offered no plans on where that money would come from. State Senator Burt Johnson of Detroit said a serious infrastructure plan would mean changes in how the state's handled funding for local governments.
If we were once considered the Paris of the North with the best mass transit system in the world, we are now considered a Rust Belt city trying to come back, and people are associating the word comeback with us. It feels good in one sense, but when you understand just how many people we've lost and for what reasons, if we're being politically honest, well, we got to do a lot better.
How the governor intends to pay for infrastructure improvements is the biggest question hanging following the speech. The governor has a budget rollout coming soon that could answer that question. There's also the issue of Flint, where state blunders helped create the city's drinking water crisis. Last year, Governor Snyder devoted nearly half his speech to the Flint water crisis. This year, the controversy rated a couple of minutes and no new plans specifically to help the city. I'm Rick Pluta at the State Capitol.
This is Current State on WKAR. Every month, we check in with Midwest environmental journalist Gary Wilson to discuss the Great Lakes. Welcome back, Gary.
Good to be with you, Mark.
January certainly off to a busy start for environmental issues. There was a Flint water town hall just last week that coincided with the one-year anniversary of the U.S. EPA's declaration of an emergency in Flint. Governor Snyder put a spotlight on the need for a big water infrastructure project in his State of the State address this week. But let's start with now ex-President Obama and his policies for the Great Lakes. He promised great things for the lakes as a candidate back in 2008. 8 years later, how did he do?
You know, he kept he did something significant. He kept a campaign pledge, which many politicians of all stripes don't do. He kept a campaign pledge to fund and implement restoration of the Great Lakes, to treat them with, and I'm going to quote here, a new standard of care. That's a phrase that was coined by Cameron Davis in 2009. Davis was his Great Lakes advisor. So Obama started what will be a decades-long process to clean up legacy toxic hotspots that are scattered around the region. You know, Michigan has about 14 of them, and the missing component there that prevented the work was always the tens of millions of dollars that all these sites, each site needs for remediation. And then when the Asian carp advance hit a tipping point in 2009, Obama's EPA diverted funds from other projects to stop the advance of the carp in the Chicago waterway system. That's the gateway to Lake Michigan. And there were countless other projects, from protecting wetlands, eliminating barriers to fish passage, and some long overdue research. The list goes on. Now, his restoration plan was essentially the one designed in the Bush administration. That's George W. the son. But Bush never funded it. It's a comprehensive plan, and one hopefully that will continue, but we'll have to see.
So where do you think his administration fell short?
Well, Mark, there's one glaring failure, and it sticks out like the proverbial sore thumb, and that's Lake Erie. Water quality in Lake Erie has steadily declined in his tenure due to nutrient runoff. Translation of nutrient runoff is farm pollution. And that led to the Toledo water crisis in 2014. I think we talked about that at the time a number of times. 400,000 people without drinking water for 3 days. The curious thing about that is in 2011, the president's then EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, said in Detroit that Lake Erie's problems would be a priority, but taking them on didn't happen. And then there's Flint. And we have to remember that Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards said that the U.S. EPA, and I'm quoting Mr. Edwards here, said that the EPA aided, abetted, and emboldened Michigan's DEQ. So Toledo and Flint happened on the watch of EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy, who left office, by the way, without ever taking responsibility for the failures. That'll be a direct reflection on Obama's legacy.
So overall, if you had to give President Obama grades for the Great Lakes and drinking water quality, what would they be?
I tend to be a tough grader, Mark, but he deserves an A for his effort on Great Lakes restoration, and I'd give him a solid B for the actual implementation of the program. Now, on drinking water quality, you know, I'd give him a D. Sadly, that may be generous.
What will his Great Lakes legacy be?
Well, I think it's going to be similar to his work on health care, the Affordable Care Act. The president did the hard work to start the process of restoring the Great Lakes, and that's significant. But it's going to be up to subsequent administrations and generations to continue what will likely be a decades-long effort, like the Health Care Act. His plan was never to be the definitive one forever. It needs to be updated, changed, improved, and it's the same thing with Great Lakes restoration.
We're talking with current state's environmental journalist Gary Wilson and reviewing recent Great Lakes news developments. Gary, in Flint last week, representatives from Governor Snyder's office, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the U.S. EPA, and others, participated in a town hall-style briefing on drinking water quality to Flint citizens. The event was hosted by Mayor Karen Weaver. What was the message to Flint citizens on the status of their drinking water?
It was a packed house, and in Flint, as you can imagine, to get the update, the message was simple, and it was a unified message, and that's 1 year after the emergency was declared in Flint by the U.S. EPA regarding the drinking water quality. That quality has improved substantially, it's still necessary for the people there to use filters, and it will be for some time. Back to Virginia Tech's Mark Edwards, real quick. He was not at the site, but he participated via Skype. And responding to a question from Mayor Weaver, he said that Flint's overall water quality is now on a par with other cities with aged infrastructure. More specifically, the attendees were told, for example, by Rich Barrett, an advisor to Governor Snyder, that Flint had gone from, and I'm quoting here, being the worst problem in the country to having the most closely monitored water system in the country. I don't know if that inspires confidence, but he said he was had to tell it like it was. And then there, Michael McDaniel from Flint's Action and Sustainability team said that replacement of the 18,000 lead pipes in Flint was going to take 3 years. And here's what's telling, that it would require an additional $100 million that really doesn't have a source now. So that was a tough but necessary message.
Governor Snyder talked about the need to invest in infrastructure in his State of the State address this week, including the need for a new Sioux Lock, which he described as a critical need. Briefly tell us about the lock and why that's important.
Well, Mark, sure. Infrastructure is on everybody's mind these days. There's only one of the locks, I believe it's the Poe Lock in the Sioux, that can handle the 1,000-foot freighters that ply the lakes. And those 1,000-footers are reported to be 60% of the ships that pass through the locks. So Should that lock fail and that commerce grind to a halt, the economic impact to the country could be staggering, according to Governor Snyder's infrastructure task force. Now, this potential new lock was first authorized by Congress in 1986, if you can believe that. I think Ronald Reagan is president. But it's never been funded over the years. It's got a hefty price tag estimated at $600 million. So that's hard for legislators to get their arms around sometimes.
Are there environmental concerns with the lock?
There are always environmental concerns with a project of this magnitude. It's a big one, but concerns always on anything you do, anytime you do construction on the Great Lakes. But I don't think the environmental concerns are paramount. It's not a pipeline. One concern is that the project would be run by the Army Corps of Engineers, which doesn't have, in the eyes of environmental groups, a real stellar environmental record. But there will be environmental studies to make sure that no harm is being done. And I suspect environmental groups will just be neutral if the project gets off the ground. It's not their highest priority, at least right now.
What are its prospects for getting funded?
Well, Mark, there's hope that with President Trump having professed an interest in big infrastructure work, that he'll help drive the project. But I'd leave your listeners with a question about this whole thing. Should the federal government use $600 million, the cost of the lock, on the lock, or should that money be directed to water infrastructure work like in Flint? Or both projects? Those are the decision that the new president and the Congress are going to have to make.
Gary Wilson is current state's environmental journalist. He joins us once a month to review recent Great Lakes news developments. Gary Wilson, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. On Friday, Donald Trump took the oath of office as our 45th president. We sent Scott Pohl and Kevin Lavery out to hear what local people thought of the ceremony.
I'm at the Sun Theater in Williamston, where the Republican Women's Federation of Michigan gathered to watch the swearing-in of their man, Donald Trump.
Linda Lee Tarver, I'm the president of the Republican Women's Federation of Michigan, and that speech really took my breath away. It was so refreshing. It spoke to my heart, especially in the inner cities. He made a promise on the campaign trail that he was criticized about African Americans. What do you have to lose? And he, in his speech to the nation, reminded us about Detroit and reminded us about our inner cities where we have family, where I have family. And his heart is there to build our inner cities, provide opportunities and jobs and education and make it safe again. And so I am committed to that myself, and I'm so happy our 45th president is committed to it as well.
My name is Sean Bertolino. I'm the mayor pro tem of the city of Williamston. And my favorite part of the speech was the president's talking about God quite a bit. He mentioned it, and quite candidly, it was refreshing to hear. I think we need more of that in this country. And also his talking about the people, that they will not be forgotten. I think that is something that the pundits, left, right, everybody has said that was a real turning point in this election. And him to address that directly several times, I think resonates with the people. And we'll see what happens over the next 4 years.
Hi, my name is Pam Smith. I'm from Williamston, and I'm here at the Sun Theater, and we watched the inauguration together. My favorite part of the speech, which really brought tears to my eyes, was the fact that Donald Trump wants to serve us, the people. The forgotten people will be forgotten no more. And that just really touched my heart.
Together, we will make America great again!
That was the scene at the Sun Theater in Williamston today as Donald Trump fans observed the inauguration.
I'm Kevin Lavery. Not everyone we spoke to viewed Donald J. Trump's historic inauguration as cause for celebration. A few people we found at Michigan State University listened to President Trump's first official address with apprehension.
My name's Devin Harrison. I thought that his speech was extremely vague and a little comical. But as for the inauguration itself, I think that one of the pastors spoke and made a really nice like prayer and impact on how we can get through this and we have to come together and really see that there's like a light at the end, but it'll all be okay. But this fight still goes on. Tomorrow's the Women's March, so I hope a lot of people come out and support women's rights and our rights in general.
This is Alex speaking. How I feel about the inauguration is just like I feel like it's really sad that he got the presidency, but I'm hoping for the best out of it anyway. Although it will be a huge change, I feel like we're going to go back in time a little bit as far as like racial things, but then again, racism has been alive and well for many years, as everyone knows. So I'm just hoping that, you know, instead of things getting worse like I think it will, I hope that things will sort of progress in a slow manner. I don't think it'll happen really fast, just considering like his tactics and what he plans to do. I feel kind of nervous, if you ask me, but I'm just holding on to hope, I guess you could say.
George Robson. I thought it was a perfect reflection of his campaign speeches, which emphasized fear and anger and change and this kind of thing, kind of appealing to his base. So I didn't think it offered the rest of the country, the majority of the voters who did not vote for him, anything in terms of compromise or looking towards the future.
My name is Jill Gashy. I don't know, it seems kind of typical. He's trying not to be too out front, seeing as he's being inaugurated today, but I think in a couple weeks there's going to be turmoil. Personally, I don't see it going as bad as everybody thinks it will, just because there's other people in there, like in Congress and the Senate and all that stuff, that are going to prevent him from doing things that he wants to do. So I think if we all have hope that it's going to be okay. Like, Donald Trump won't be able to do as much as he says he will, and I think that even though the inauguration of him is upsetting, that it's going to be okay in the end.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And I'm Scott Pohl.
The East Lansing Trojans boys basketball team is top dog in the CAAC Blue. Junior forward Brandon Johns leads the team and is ranked as a top 50 player in the nation for the 2018 class. That talent was never more evident than last week when he led his team to a win over Holt after being down 16 points and battling through an eye injury. Head coach of the Trojans, Steve Finnemore, talked with Current sports host Al Martin about the potential of his team and the impact of Johns, a player that's steadily improved since his freshman campaign.
Well, he's matured. You know, that's the one thing. And some kids do not mature over 3 years in high school. A lot of kids come in high school from middle school, you know, as entitled, pampered, whiny type kids. And you know, Brandy has not done that. None of our players really have done that. But you see that around the landscape of high school basketball. You know, kids do not mature over 4 years. And Brandon's matured, like, so much. And he knew he had to get back out there to help his teammates. And that's exactly what he did. That was his mindset. He said, I'm not going to sit out this game. I'm going to come back and help my team win.
Are you shocked in any way at the start of your club?
Yes and no, Al. And when I say no, I'm not shocked. I don't want to sound, you know, egotistical. I just think, you know, sometimes you're going to get everyone's best shot, so you got to come mentally prepared. And I think that's what this team has done. They have the talent, they have the skill, but it comes to now, it comes down to the mental part. We talk about the mindset every day. You know, grit, GRIT, is our slogan this year. And we're really working the guys hard in practice, like we're 0-0. And every day is going to be a heavyweight title. And you know, the guys are looking forward to the Okemos game. We got past last night's game. We're going to get some shots up today in the gym. And we're going to prepare for Okemos. So I would say yes and no that I'm shocked. So, but it's a lot of fun being around these guys. I'll tell you, they surprise you every day.
Steve, the mental aspect of basketball is so important. You know that. Oh. And for you, how do you go about mentally preparing this team just to go out and take it game after game after game and not think about having that donut in the loss column?
Well, people will say it's a cliche, but I treat it as a lesson. Every single day, Al, you got to bring your best, no matter how you feel. You can't just come and work hard on days you feel good. When there are days you're a little tired, maybe you got a little nick or two, you know, you got to come out there and play, especially on game night. You know, you can't not practice during the week and expect to play on the game on Tuesdays and Fridays. So I would say every single day, Al, you have to give your best. And there's a reason why there's only a few successful, highly successful people in life, in all walks of life, actually, in all different professions, is because those leaders, those successful people, they give everything they got every single day.
Love that message. Steve, who's the most challenging team in the CAAC Blue right now for you all? Is it Holt? Is Holt the biggest threat to you all possibly winning the division?
You know, Dwayne Stevens, MSU assistant coach, said something to me the other night. we were chatting after the Holt game, and obviously it was 2 days before the Ohio State game. And I said to DJ, I said, hey, DJ, I said, you got a big game on Sunday. And he looked at me. He goes, Steve, he goes, all the games are big. So to really, really answer your question, every single team is going to give you their best shot. Now, it's all a matter of, are you going to counter? Are you going to take the blows? And are you going to stand up if you get knocked down during the game? So each game, Al, and I don't want to sound like a cliche machine here, but like I said, I use cliches as lessons in life. Okemos is going to be the hardest team, you know, that we've played all season.
Steve, you made a comment after that win over Holt that I want to bring up to you.
Yep.
You talked about Brandon Johns and how there was a moment during that game where you looked at him and said, you know, why would you want to go play for a prep school? Look at this. And it was an amazing atmosphere. I mean, you got the student section that stormed the side of the court and the players are going wild. Why did you make that statement to Brandon Johns? And what separates high school basketball in relation to prep school?
Well, there's a lot of things that separate it, Al. And you and I can talk about this for forever and ever. But the reason why I brought it up to Brandon during that moment was it was an electric atmosphere. And number one of the things you don't have in prep school is electric atmospheres. Now, promoters can set up a game between two highly ranked prep schools and have it in a big arena and sell tickets for $20. Yeah, everybody will come out and watch it because there's marquee players. But every single night, you know, in high school, you're going to have big time games. And I just felt it was the right time to say to Brandon, because there's been a lot of talk about him. Hey, is he going to go to prep school? You got people actually starting rumors that he's going to prep school. So I just wanted to let him know, hey, listen, buddy, there's no way in any place in this country you can get this kind of atmosphere. And I said, why would you want to leave this? Plus, he's a great teammate. You know, Al, there's a lot of reasons why players go to prep schools, you know, a lot of negative reasons why they leave, pack up, leave, and go, maybe to get their academics right. Maybe they need to get out of a certain environment because there's a lot of trouble, blah, blah, blah. Brandon's got a great life here in East Lansing. He's got great teachers, great teammates. His family's awesome. So there's no reason for Brandon Johns to go to prep school.
I want to pose this question to you, Steve, before we get out of here. Is AAU basketball hurting or helping youth athletes who play on the hardwood?
I think it goes both ways, Al. I think it hurts a kid, and I think it could help a kid. You have two chances, two choices, two opportunities. Now, number one, Al, if you get with a really good program, which, by the way, like most things in life, there's one little thing that hurts the whole picture, but there are a lot of good AAU programs out there, and we have some here in our own backyard in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to get with a really good program. As a parent, you got to do your homework. You got to put your kid in the right situation, as opposed to some bad programs out there that if you get stuck with them, you know, you're going to wind up leaving. You know, with the AAU programs, you get a lot of exposure, and maybe playing for your high school team, you know, you're not being used the right way. You're not playing the position you like to play in college. So with that AAU team, you can play. Al, these kids play 80 to 100 games in the summer and the spring combined. We play 20 games in a season here, and if you're lucky, you can move on in the playoffs. So exposure is a big thing for kids, you know, recruiting, rankings, you know, so that helps. So there is good and bad on both sides. The refereeing is not very good in AAU games. I encourage my players to play AAU basketball because it can help them. I'd rather have them playing AAU basketball, Al, than hanging out on their couch or hanging out in the mall on the weekend.
Steve Finnemore, head coach of the East Lansing boys basketball team.
And that wraps this edition of Current State. Thank you for joining us. Next week on WKAR News, the Lansing City Council is embroiled in a leadership dispute 3 weeks into the new year and still no council president or vice president. But what awaits the council after the dust settles? I'll ask council members Jessica Yorko and Carol Wood. That and lots, lots more next week on WKAR. The Current State production team includes Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and Jamie Paisley. Thanks also to engineer Drew Hill. Current State's executive producer is Peter Worf, and I'm Mark Bayshore. The Current State podcast, an informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with mid-Michigan topics that run the gamut. It's your informative, insightful, indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan. Have a great weekend. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.